Well, now it's time for this week's industry review. And on the day that at the Aviva Stadium, we'll be watching an Irish team with mobile phone company Three emblazoned on their shirts, a French team sponsored by insurance company GMF, all battling to win the Royal Bank of Scotland sponsored Six Nations trophy. It is perhaps appropriate that sponsorship is today's subject. Sponsorships can be worth a lot of money to both sides. It's estimated that Chevrolet paid just over a whopping €70 million a year to sponsor Manchester United, whilst Coca-Cola shelled out nearly €90 million to be one of the main sponsors for London 2012. That's the Olympics. But how does sponsorship work, and does it really deliver a return on investment? To unpick those issues, I'm joined in studio now by Mick O'Keefe, Chief Executive of PSG Communications, Niall McGrath, who's Marketing Director of Richmond Marketing, and also on the phone I have Pat Nally, who's a sports marketing consultant. Gentlemen, you're all very welcome to the show. Mick, a busy day in sport, a lot of companies spending a lot of money to sponsor things. Are they really getting value for money, or are they just doing it so their CEOs can feel good and get tickets to games?
Well, you'd think I would say yes, but it really depends. There is a little bit of chairman's choice sometimes when it comes to sponsorship, but I think the sponsorship market has evolved hugely here. We estimate that it's worth about €120 million, of which about 80% is sport. Taking your point around today, I suppose it really depends what a company wants to achieve with sponsorship. For some companies, say like Aviva, when they came to town, it was about brand awareness. They didn't have any brand awareness. So how better to get brand awareness than sponsor the National Stadium, well one of the National Stadiums, you say, as well as Croke Park, obviously. For some people, it's about changing brand sentiment. They want people to think more kindly about them, so banks, insurance companies, etc. For some people, it's about customer retention and customer loyalty. So say in heavy switching environments like energy, for argument's sake, some people use sponsorship as a way to reward their customers. So I think sponsorship works. I think it works if it's done correctly and activated properly, and I think it's done if it works if people set out and measured it in the right way. I think there has been an element of, in this country, maybe 30 years ago, where I think there was a kind of a mix up between what's patronage and what's sponsorship. A guy sponsoring his local county team, a meat baron or a hotelier, is that really sponsorship, or is that someone putting something back? Where sponsorship for me is very much about using sponsorship to achieve business objectives.
And I mean, is there a way nowadays of measuring whether the X million euros you've invested has really delivered?
Yeah, of course there is. And you know, there's lots of different ways people measure sponsorship. People measure it around share of voice. People measure it now around there's sophisticated tools around how many times logos have appeared and stuff like that. That's from a pure kind of share of voice point of view. Others are far more sophisticated, and they look at ways like can they directly point to consumer sales based on the sponsorship. So take, for example, AIG is a client of ours, not IAG, I should add, our client of ours. We would have been involved in selling the Dublin sponsorship to them. If you look at the results that they've had, everything from their staff retention levels have actually gone from something like 15% churn to less than 7% churn. You look at their consumer, they use sponsorship to show a more consumer side because they're more in the commercial lines of insurance. Their consumer sales have gone up over 80% this year. So they directly attribute the Dublin GA sponsorship to better staff morale, more sales, and that obviously has had an impact on the bottom line.
Niall, if I could just bring you in here, your company, Richmond Marketing, would do all the sponsorship activity for Red Bull in Ireland. They've taken a slightly different approach, and it seems to have been very successful. What do they do that's different to other companies?
Well, unlike other companies where they actually pay to actually get the rights for to put their logo on their naming rights on someone else's platform, Red Bull actually create their own platforms, and that gives them a lot of different kind of things that they can do with it. But it also gives them standout. It gives them flexibility to do what they want to do with the actual platform. Their image becomes a lot clearer, they feel, from doing it that way. Their values come through a lot clearer. It also gives them real credibility with their target market. And it gives them a chance to really deeply engage with those consumers who turn up the events. Like, we have an event happening next weekend in Belfast. And over the two nights, we've already sold 31,000 tickets to that event. So it really gives you a chance to get your target market and get up close and personal with them and really get, in our case, cans in hand, but also get them to see our brand and what it does And how it's different from all of our competitors.
We've spoken quite a bit about sports as a vehicle for sponsorship, but you also see moving into other areas, for instance, the arts. Is that something that kind of works for some of your clients?
Yeah, it does for many clients. For Red Bull in particular, it gives them, as I said, it gives you an opportunity to show your brand image is much broader. A lot of people think the brand is quite narrow in its focus or in extreme sports, but it actually is a much broader brand. It gives wings to people and ideas. That's its positioning. And by moving into things like the arts, or gaming, along with extreme sports, it gives them the opportunity to show the breadth of the brand and its brand positioning.
Pat, I'd like to bring you in now. Pat, you've been involved in sports marketing for many years. Perhaps just talk a little bit about your involvement with the World Cup. What did you do there, or what did you help bring to it that really changed the nature of how that was run as an event?
Going back to the 70s when we started, sports sponsorship wasn't really developed. Sports didn't understand sponsorship, didn't understand about rights, didn't understand what they owned. And this also included FIFA. I did have the privilege of bringing Mr. Blatter into FIFA when we employed him from Longines to work with us on the...
Any regrets for that move?
Well, maybe, but hasn't he done well? But he came in to help us with the FIFA Coca-Cola development program, which was to help FIFA develop the football into Asia and Africa, which were sort of minor nations back in those days. And, of course, FIFA didn't really control its World Cup. So my first involvement with the World Cup was back in Argentina in 1978. And that because of our interest to protect Coca-Cola as a principal sponsor, we had to bring all the rights back under sort of central control, under FIFA control, so that the rights to Coca-Cola could be sort of protected. And that was really the early start of international federations sort of understanding the obligations that they are going to need if they were going to enter into these sort of commercial relationships. And, of course, we've seen it grow not only with FIFA but with the IOC and with most major international sports, with IRB and rugby, of course, have all now developed very, very sophisticated programs involving commercial sponsors.
One thing that interests me is some of these relationships are very long and enduring. It's not like you go and you sponsor one Olympics or one Six Nations series. Why do companies commit for such a long amount of time, and how do they think about it when they're plotting out that investment?
It really depends on companies' objectives. You've been talking about measurement, you've been talking about what Red Bulls or other people want. Obviously, the clear thing that is required is a very clear understanding of the objectives of why a company is entering into such a sponsorship arrangement. Now, if you're a company like Coca-Cola with a brand that wants to have that brand associated with the world's global sport on a continuous basis, you're going to continue your relationship for many years. And Coca-Cola, having signed in 1975, are still a principal sponsor of FIFA today. Other companies where they're trying to perhaps launch a new brand or are trying to do something different to where it is over a period of time, they may need to build in an exit strategy because obviously, it's also difficult sometimes to come out. So you need to plan in as part of your objectives on your program the length of time to where it's going to be effective. So it's really horses for courses. Everybody needs to understand what it is that they're trying to achieve.
Mick, I just wanted to look at one sometimes controversial issue, which is naming rights of stadiums. It's the Aviva Stadium now. We've almost been taught now we're not allowed to call it Lansdowne Road. We see a lot of different stadiums around the country. Croke Park, will that ever potentially sell off naming rights?
I was actually asked this question a couple of weeks ago, and my gut feeling is no, but I'd never say never. I don't think the GA needs the money. The GA is hugely successful and commercially driven organisation, and their multi-sponsor model, which is a copy, I suppose, of Patrick's kind of visionary stuff back in 1978, is doing a great job for them, and broadcast deals do a great job for them. I would say no. I'd say if you're putting a value on it, I'd say you'd be looking at $5 million a year or more, because it is absolutely iconic as a stadium, and even more again, I'd say. Where naming rights work is when it tends to be a new build or a rebuild. I think going in and putting a sticker on a stadium, I think there's a lot of consumer suspicion around that, and I think it takes a lot of time. But if you take the three big ones in Ireland, which is the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre, which was Grand Canal Theatre, but it was a new building. You take the Point Depot, which was basically rebuilt and was called the O2, and you take Lansdowne, which was knocked and rebuilt and became the Aviva. So that kind of sentiment and loyalty to the old name tends to go. I do think we're in an interesting space at the moment, because You look at things like Irish Independent Park. You now have Kingspan Stadium has been quite successful now. It's actually rooted in. It took a bit of time to wash Ravenhill out, but again, that was a new build.
Just on that point of washing the old name.
Yeah.
I mean, is it that sports journalists are put under pressure to make sure in their copy they refer to the stadium? Do you suddenly find your press pass for an event might be withdrawn if you insisted on calling it Lansdowne Road in your copy?
I'm not sure if they'd withdraw the press pass, but because they need the oxygen of the coverage. But I think there is pressure on sports desks, particularly print sports desks, to call it by its name. I think this is an age-old argument that goes on and on and on. And I think sports journalists, sports people and sponsors understand that sport needs money. Sponsors give sports money. And without it, I don't think it's going to survive. So I think there's an element of, I do think that sports desks do play ball, so to speak. It can take time. It did take time with Ravenhill. Now Kingspan is established. There is pressure. And I think the way that it's controlled is that when fixtures come out or on broadcast, so if you do a broadcast deal with RTE, for argument's sake, they will have to, as part of their contract, name check the sponsors and call them by the right name. So that element is controlled. And also when fixtures go out from the IRFU or the GAA, they will say, you know, at Kingspan Stadium, at Irish Independent Park. And over time, a lot of those are PDF fixtures and they get PDF and put down on the page as well. So there is that element of control.
Just, Niall, another thing that's become much, much bigger now is programme sponsorship. I mean, here in News Talk, we would have substantial sponsorship of programmes. You see it on RTE. Is that something that a lot of brands find attractive, to wrap themselves around a particular show?
Yeah, they do. I think it comes back to mixed points again. It all depends on what your objective is. I suppose if it is the right target market, the right target audience, or if it is the right type of show, it shares the same kind of values as your brand, yes, it could be the right thing to do. Some of my brands actually do engage in it, that they look after. Others it's not right for. But I suppose it depends on the brand, what it's trying to do, what it stands for, and then it depends on their objectives again.
Some of the most successful sponsorships were media sponsorships. You know, if you go back to The Simpsons and Domino's, I think, I hope it's Domino's. Yeah. And there was Bailey's, I think, and Friends. And, you know, when there's a strong brand association with the product, similar to sports sponsorship, it makes a lot of sense. And you see a lot of mobiles or banks, etc., would go for business shows because it's business solutions and so forth are attracted to, because it's a corporate audience.
And it could be a cheap way of getting to an audience. Like, I've seen brands like such as Nike kind of going over the top of brands who might be the name right sponsor of a particular event and then sponsor the show which is going out.
Pat, is there any danger that this goes a bit too far and that, you know, sports fans can start to push back against it? I mean, we had Rory McIlroy in court very recently and, you know, it really reminded us of the huge amounts of money involved and you know, golf starting to become all about money and not about, you know, great gifted sportsmen. Where is that line?
There is a big problem, and we're seeing it more and more because you're getting criticism about transparency and governance of international federations, of other federations, that the whole commercial sort of momentum that's come with broadcast money and with sponsor money is putting pressures on organisations to become very different than what they are, because federations, domestic and international federations, have predominantly been run by people that have come through the sport. And now, of course, it's big business. It's big business. It needs lawyers. It needs corporate sponsors that have some views. There needs to be a more sort of, I think, open sort of review to how these things are sort of monitored, how these things are presented. People need to understand more. So, yeah, there is a risk that if it isn't sort of controlled in some way, that it will get out of hand.
And finally, Mick, last word to you.
Sure. I mean,
sports administrators now need to be much more business savvy. Is the calibre of our people managing sport good enough to get the gains that they can get from sponsorship?
That's a very, very good question. I do think, on Patrick's point, I think there's an interesting, you know, there's so much money in sport at the moment that the calibre of people in sport and governance in sport has to be absolutely top notch. I think the Sports Council has done a great job in terms of that governance piece with NGBs. The short answer is it's sports governance is going to have to improve. As I describe Step Blatter sometimes as the Frank Underwood of sport.
And okay.
On Thursday week, obviously, we're on the Sponsorship Summit in Croke Park too, so more of this will be discussed there and then.
There we go. Mick O'Keefe, look forward to that event. Mick O'Keefe, CEO of PSG Communications. Niall McGrath, Marketing Director at Richmond Marketing, and Pat Nally, Sports Marketing Consultant. Thank you all very much, gentlemen, for joining me.